Good afternoon. I call the Senate Resource Committee to order. Today's Wednesday, April 12, 2023. The time is 3:30. Please turn off all cell phones. Present today, Co-Chair Geisel, Senator Dunbar, Senator Kaufman, Senator Kawasaki, Senator Klayman, and Senator Vice Chair Willikowski will be joining us momentarily. And he is here. And myself, Co-Chair Bishop, I'd like to thank Carrie Cooper, writer of Andy Kraft today for staffing us. And today's agenda will be SB 78, hunting, fishing license for non-resident students. Consideration of the governor's appointee, Jacob Fletcher, to the Board of Game. We're going to take public testimony on SB 92, state ownership of suburbs lands, Senator Geisel's bill, and the first hearing will be today on SB 69 geothermal resources by the governor. And then I think last but not least, we're going to leave on a high note by Alaska's geothermal, our own Bernie Carl, president of Chena Power. So with that, SB 78 hunting fishing license for non-residents committee action. We had set a previous amendment deadline. No amendments were received. I would now like to the co-chair for a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill 78, version 33LS0372/A-alpha, out of committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
Seeing no objections, the bill moves from the committee. We will sign the report at the next brief at ease, which will be forthcoming. Next up, we're going to go to consideration of governor appointees, and we're going to have Mr. Jacob Fletcher, who's on the phone, and he's appointed to the Board of Game. Welcome to Senate Resources, Mr. Fletcher. Thank you for being here today. Please state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you very much. For the record, my name is Jacob Fletcher, and can you guys hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much, Madam Chair, Mr. Chairman, and all the members of the committee. I've prepared a short statement here that I'm going to read. I live in Talkeetna. I'm married, and we have 10-year-old twins. I own a small, big game guiding business that predominantly operates on Kodiak Island for several weeks in the spring and the fall. And I was recently awarded a federal guide youth area at the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge. And I'm very much looking forward to operating there starting in 2024. In the summer months, I operate a vessel for Mahay's Jet Boat Adventures in Talkeetna. In this job, I introduce guests to foreign fauna and history of our little piece of the Susitna River and the Talkeetna River. In the winter months, I own and operate a small snow machine tourism business, and I occasionally help out guiding and training at Dallas Stevie's Dog Kennel in Talkeetna. And that's a dog kennel and a business that my wife manages. My family and I are avid outdoors people. We feel very blessed to live in a state that affords us so much opportunity when it comes to filling our freezers. I've worked as a packer, an assistant guide, and a registered guide for over 20 years, and I'm very familiar with the way that game regulations are implemented in the field. I've served one previous term on the Board of Game. The commitment by the Department of Fish and Game, the Department of Law, the Subsistence Division, and the Board support staff that work tirelessly to make sure that all the board members and all the public are informed, as well as our local AC's participation and the public that choose to participate, make this process quite simply the best in the world, and I feel very blessed and humbled to have been a part of it. As a consumptive and a non-consumptive user, I will continue to look out for the wild game in this state as well as its residents, and I would appreciate an affirmative vote when it comes to my confirmation. I would be happy to try to answer any questions that you might have for me at this time. Thank you.
Questions from committee members? Seeing none, we'll now go to public comment, and we're going to go to Mark Richards, resident hunters of Alaska and Fairbanks. Mr. Richards, are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can. Please put yourself on the record and give your testimony. 2 minutes, please.
Yep. Good afternoon, Co-Chair Bishop, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mark Richards. I'm the Executive Director of Resident Hunters of Alaska. an organization of over 3,200 members from across the state that advocates for sustainable wildlife management policies geared toward enhancing and prioritizing resident hunting opportunities. Calling in from snowy Fairbanks today, where winter is unfortunately clinging on. Regarding Mr. Fletcher's reappointment to the Board of Game, I have to remain neutral and just reiterate our position that the current makeup of the Board of Game is completely unbalanced in favor of commercial hunting interests in a way that has never happened before. Mr. Fletcher is currently one of the five licensed guides and one retired guide on the seven-member Board of Game. If Mr. Fletcher is reappointed, he will then be one of four guides on the seven-member board. Still an imbalance that we don't really approve of. This is a no-win situation for us. If we oppose Mr. Fletcher's reappointment, we get wrongly dinged again as being against guides when we're only looking out for resident hunter interests. And we have no doubt Jake will be confirmed. He's a good man. I have a lot of respect for him. I really do. I don't expect you to vote against him now, especially if you voted for him the last time to put even more guides on the board. I just want to make sure you understand where we're coming from. And I look forward sincerely to talking to some of you again soon on ways to reform the Board of Game as well as the Board of Fish so we are not managing our fish and wildlife on a pendulum swing that depends on who the current governor is, his or her choice for commissioner and Board of Fish and Game seats. We need to ensure balanced boards are in everyone's best interest. Thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Richards from committee members? Seeing none, Mr. Richards, thank you for your testimony. Next, we're going to go to Wayne Kubit, Alaska Professional Hunters Association, Wasilla.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Co-Chair Geisel and Bishop and Senate Resource Committee members. I'm Wayne Kubit, Vice President of the Alaska Professional Hunters Association, APHA for short. I'm testifying on their behalf. APHA supports the reappointment of Mr. Jake Fletcher to the Alaska Board of Game. Mr. Fletcher lives full-time in rural Alaska. He understands the unique challenges of living and working remotely. He also knows firsthand the importance of our wildlife resources to Alaska's rural communities. APHA believes that Jake brings unique viewpoints and experiences from across the state to the board process. Furthermore, he has shown himself to be accessible to the public, willing to listen to all sides of an issue, and committed to making the best decisions on wildlife issues that he possibly can. APHA respectfully asks that you support the appointment of Mr. Fletcher to the Board of Game. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Kubit, for your testimony. Anyone in the room wishing to testify? Seeing none, public testimony is now closed. That concludes our appointees for today. Senator Geisel.
The Senate Resources Committee has reviewed the qualifications of the governor's appointee and recommends that the following name be forwarded to a joint session for consideration. Board of Game, Jacob Corson Fletcher. This does not reflect intent of any members to vote for or against this individual during any further sessions for the purposes of confirmation.
Thank you. This name will be forwarded to the joint session. Please be sure to sign the committee report before we leave today. Next up, SB 92, State Ownership of Submerged Lands. This is the second hearing of the bill. Today we'll be taking public testimony. So let me switch screens here on public testimony. And we're going to go to Mr. Craig Compo in Fairbanks. Mr. Compo, can you hear us?
I can. Can you hear me?
Yes. Put yourself on the record in 2 minutes of testimony, please.
Yeah, my name is Craig Compo. I'm a 62-year-old resident of Alaska. Full disclosure, I also sell boats. 62 years seems like a long time until you consider we've been watching these federal agencies. Under state ownership. Ownership that was given to Alaska statehood. And in all that time, the feds have recognized there's 9% of these rivers under their navigable designation. There's almost 1 million miles of river in Alaska, and only 9% have been designated as navigable, dating back to when the Boeing 707 jetliner first came into service. Now, I know healthcare is improving and people are living longer than ever, but if my math is correct, at the current rate, I'd have to make it to almost 700 years old to see this process to completion. For sure, my grandchildren, great-grandchildren, great-great-grandchildren won't see even half of our rivers get the designation correctly identified if we're to wait for these agencies to get the job done. But it never really should have been up to them anyway, specifically after 1959. It's time we as a state finally say enough is enough. All of you are aware the landmark unanimous Sturgeon decisions that have not changed the mindset of the agenda-driven agencies like the National Park Service and others help bent on slowing the process to meet their objectives. And that is to control, redefine, and outright steal everything Alaskans want and won for its statehood. No change has been made to the NPS regulations on hovercraft in Alaska, even with this unanimous decision or decisions from the U.S. Supreme Court now years after it's passed. 2023 can finally be the year we do it. Here we said we're mad as hell and we're not, the year we said we're mad as hell, I'm not going to take it anymore. You as the body need to, in no uncertain terms, make clear with this legislation that we're finally taking control of what we were promised at statehood, and that is simple. 100% ownership in Alaska in interest in all submerged underlying navigable water, including those in federal areas. We've been trying to play the nice like Alaskans are known for over six decades, and well, now it's our turn. This bill will allow the state of Alaska under the DNR commissioner to do what the feds completely and intentionally failed to do, determine in a timely and responsible fashion the names and locations of those waters deemed clearly navigable using legal and accepted descriptions of navigable water, including those within the boundaries of and adjacent to federal areas. We've been sharing pins in deep water for too long. I thank this body for your time and service, and on behalf of myself and as well as my future great-great-grandchildren, I support SB 92. Thank you.
Questions from committee members? Seeing none, Mr. Compo, would you send your testimony to my office and I'll distribute it to the committee? There was a couple of times when some of your testimony didn't come through on our communications here, so we'd appreciate that.
I'll be happy to, Senator Bishop. Thank you.
Yes. Next, we're going to go to Fairbanks to Mike Pinker. Mr. Pinker, are you online? Introduce yourself for the record in 2 minutes, please.
I am Mike Tinker. I'm about the same number of years as Compo. I've been here in the interior and involved in the natural resource issues for a long time. And I thank you all for the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 92 this afternoon. We see this, or I see this and on behalf of my family and as a fight against overreach. You're all aware of the Sturgeon example of a fight that absolutely went nowhere. We have no changes in regulation after two wins of the Supreme Court. We think that the amendment to the bill just put in the other day by Senator Giesel is just fine. Clarify what's happening a little bit, and certainly we're testifying in support of the bill. One of the things that's interesting here is that I've been personally involved with working with the resources on some of the navigable river interest numbers, as Mr. Compo talked about. And we have been encouraging them to take a systematic approach, and that's what the governor's bill does. It says we're not going to take this, one little piece of river at a time, but we're going to take the entire system as defined by the act, do it. And in addition to the equal footing doctrine that DNR has referenced here, there's also the Dinkum Sands Supreme Court decision that gave the state authority over submerged land. There's actually more horsepower in here than originally brought forth. And with that, Senator, I would be happy to answer any questions and wish you well.
Thank you, Mr. Tinker. I don't see any questions from committee members, and have a great day. Thank you. Anybody in the room would like to testify on Senate Bill 92? Seeing none, we're going to close public testimony. The committee has set an amendment deadline of April 13th, tomorrow at noon. We're going to take a brief at ease while we set up the next presentation and sign the bill packet. call the Senate Resources Committee back to order. Senate Bill 69, Geothermal Resources. This will be our first hearing. I would like to invite Commissioner Designee John Boyle. Looks like he's calling in from Delta Junction, Big D. So, Mr. Commissioner Boyle, if you're there and you can hear us, would you like to give your introductory remarks?
Yeah, thank you. Co-Chair Bishop, Co-Chair Giesel, members of the committee, this is John Boyle, Commissioner Designee for the Department of Natural Resources, for the record. Thank you for allowing me to testify remotely today as I tour our beautiful interior Alaska. As you all know from our conversation during some of the hearings that we've had in front of your committee, one of the most important priorities I think that we as CNR need to take up is advancing Alaska's energy security. And that really involves taking a hard look at what energy resources we have available in the state and ensuring that our statutes and our regulations are set up to encourage and promote, you know, the exploration and development of those energy resources. And in particular with geothermal energy, as we all know, the state sits on the Ring of Fire. We have a number of areas within the state that should be very highly conducive for geothermal exploration and development. But the state hasn't taken any significant effort to delineate and characterize its geothermal resources in decades. And part of the challenge that we've seen at DNR in encouraging more exploration of these resources is based on the nature of the leasing statutes that we have that relate to geothermal exploration work. So we really believe that this bill is important to help support those individuals and entities interested in exploring and characterizing the state's geothermal resources to be able to go out and identify where these areas may be and hopefully help us understand more about the resources that we have so that we can look to develop these really critical and essential energy resources across the state. And of course, as technology has progressed, we believe that there are multiple opportunities to develop geothermal resources, not only along kind of our volcanic chain, but also areas across the interior where we have known warm and hot springs. So we're really looking forward to sharing this piece of legislation with the committee. We think it's an important piece of legislation, and we look forward to having this discussion with you and answering any questions that we can around our geothermal leasing program. So thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much for calling in today. And next up, we're going to bring Mr. Carruthers, John, and Dr. LePain, our state geologist and director of Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys, up to do the presentation. And just for full disclosure for the committee here today, we're going to go through the presentation and we're going to kind of set the bill aside. We'll have our sectional at our next meeting. When we bring the bill up again, we want to give Mr. Carl plenty of time to do his presentation. I'm sure he's going to generate some Q&A from the committee. So with that being said, and we also have available online to the committee members for questions, Mr. Sean Clifton, Aaron Quinn, and Brett Huber. So those folks are available online for questions as well. So welcome today to both of you. If you put yourselves on the record and start your presentation, please.
Thank you, Chair Bishop, members of the committee. For the record, this is John Crowther, Deputy Commissioner. As you alluded to, Chair, we'll be presenting really the first eight slides of the packet today with our state geologist, Dr. LePain, here. And then, depending on committee questions, we may also present, starting on slide 29 of your deck, some of the supplemental map information, if time permits. But without further ado, I'll turn it over to Dr. LePain.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner Crowther. Thank you, Chair Bishop, and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. This is going to be a very high-level introduction to geothermal energy in five slides, so I'm not going to do a deep dive at all. So this first slide, the graphic on the left is just a cartoon showing a typical high-temperature hydrothermal system where you're using the hot water at depth to power turbines and generate electricity. And so essentially what you need an elevated geothermal gradient. Okay, that's the increase in temperature as you go deeper in the earth. You need porosity and permeability for the migration of fluids. That's for a conventional hydrothermal system. You need surface access, and you need a sufficiently large thermal system so that you can build a large enough power plant to generate a large enough amount of power so that you can distribute it and make a significant contribution to the electrical grid. And obviously, you need customers for that power. So just describing that diagram on the left, you have a power plant at the surface. That's pretty straightforward. You have one or more production wells. That's shown with the red arrows. And you're moving a hot fluid up from depth. And that depth could be anywhere from several hundred feet down to more than a few miles. And that hot fluid can be, you know, multiple hundreds of degrees Fahrenheit, 300, 400 degrees Fahrenheit. And it goes into the system, and it turns a turbine, and the turbine generates power. And once the fluid has gone through that process, it cools down, and then you move the fluid back to an injection well, and you re-inject it. And you re-inject it some distance away from your production wells because you don't want to kind of short-circuit and just form a circulation loop. You'll end up producing water that's not hot enough because you're producing water that you just injected. So you have to kind of separate them. That's easy to do as long as you have the surface access. So that's just, in a basic sense, how a conventional hydrothermal power plant would work with high-temperature geothermal resource. So if there are no questions, I'll move on to the – go ahead.
I have a question. So, Mr. Carruthers, in this scenario here, would this reinjection well have to have a Class 6 certification?
Yeah, Chair Bishop, John Crowther, Deputy Commissioner for the Record. So geothermal wells have to be under Class 5 of the Underground Injection Control Program, the U.S. EPA administration of the Safe Drinking Water Act. And Class 5 is for the injection of non-hazardous fluids. Those fluids in geothermal, it's often saline water, so it's not hazardous, and so it's under that non-hazardous class. Class 6, as you referenced, is for the injection of carbon dioxide for carbon sequestration purposes. So the permitting authority there, depending on the specifics of the well, may fall into that Class 5 EPA requirement.
Just a follow-up. And what's the timeline for getting a Class 5 certification?
Yeah, so the legislation before us does contemplate authorizing AOGCC to potentially investigate receiving Class 5 primacy for geothermal wells. Right now, the EPA, as we understand it, doesn't promote the authorization of that single segment of Class 5 wells. Class 5 wells also include the injection for many other purposes, so non-geothermal injection of non-hazardous fluids. But this legislation includes that authority for the investigation in the event the future the EPA does provide that because of the growth of the geothermal industry. I don't know the exact time frames for other Class 5 permits issued through the EPA. The EPA has the ability to issue them directly to applicants without a state assuming that primacy. It's our understanding, we have talked about Class 6 wells taking, in some cases, several years for that review because they're relatively novel, relatively complex to inject carbon dioxide, technically complex. These geothermal wells are much more traditional and simple, and so the permits are not so extended to receive through EPA is our current understanding. But certainly the timeliness of receiving permitting, if we had geothermal prospects move forward in Alaska under the authority provided in this legislation, and we did see slow delays in permitting, which we don't expect, but if we did see that, we would potentially come back to the legislature with concepts to allow the state to assume and ameliorate that delay. But right now, we're not expecting there to be significant delays with those permits if they're required.
All right. Thank you. Please continue. Oh, Senator Co-Chair Giesel, sorry.
Thanks. So the fluids that you're bringing up, what's the likelihood that they might contain minerals? For example, zinc, maybe even uranium. I don't know how dissolvable uranium is, but what are those chances?
It's very possible. It all depends on the rocks that the fluid is coming from and what has dissolved or leached out of the rocks into the water. I know in Nevada, where they have been producing electrical power from geothermal energy now for decades, they are now starting to look at geothermal fluids as a potential source for lithium. And so they're finding lithium in some of those produced fluids, not in all of them, but in some of them. So they're really starting to look seriously at how to extract it. So that's a very real possibility, but it depends on the rocks that the water is coming from.
So lithium, is that considered a hazardous substance? If a class 5 well is to inject non-hazardous material and you're re-injecting?
Lithium in, through the chair, Senator Geisel, lithium in the water, it would depend on the concentration. You wouldn't want to drink a high concentration of water with or water with a high concentration of lithium. I'm sure the EPA has a regulatory standard regarding that. I would imagine they do. I don't know for sure. But how that would affect the regulations regarding the wells, I would defer to Deputy Commissioner Crowther.
Yeah, Chair Bishop and Co-Chair Geisel, John Crowther here for the record. We can get back to the committee with the kind of exact specifications about those where those considerations for the different classes of wells fall. It's our understanding that at the concentrations you typically see cycling in the geothermal systems, that class 5 non-hazardous is the applicable category. In theory, you could discover a geothermal fluid that does have a hazardous substance at concentration in it that you might have to make accommodations for in your permitting, but most of the water is essentially saline brine with trace elements. As Dr. LePain mentioned, those efforts to concentrate and filter out lithium or other produced substances are usually quite diffuse in the overall fluid, as we understand it.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So one final comment on this slide. What I described, as I said, is a conventional high-temperature hydrothermal system. If you have hot, dry rocks at depth, you can essentially inject water into those rocks. If you have a fracture network, a porous a substrate with a fracture network, and you can circulate that water through those hot, dry rocks and then produce them some distance away and then run them through a power plant. And then same thing, as after the water has gone through the power plant, it's going to have cooled down, and you inject it some distance away and you start the process over again. So you don't have to have the subsurface fluid being hot. You have to have hot rocks. That's what you have to have. So if there are no questions,
I'll please continue.
Okay. So this is a map of the state of Alaska, and essentially a heat flow map. It's showing natural heat flow from the Earth. The Earth is a layered system. We have radioactive minerals at depth. Those radioactive minerals decay, and part of that decay process generates heat. And that's essentially where the heat flow is coming from in the interior of the planet. This map is a little misleading. It tends to convey an impression that everywhere you go and you punch a hole in the ground, you're going to have elevated heat flow like this. Well, this map is based on relatively few data points, and so they contour the data points. And so I just want to throw that out so that there's some understanding of how this map is made. But it does convey correctly that much of the state is thought to have slightly elevated heat flow. Okay, and then the final point and the important point that I want to make, if you look at that map, you'll see in the central part of the state running from the Seward Peninsula on the west all the way east almost, well, probably to at least Circle and Central Hot Springs, you see those white symbols. Those are geothermal springs. Okay, you see a small cluster in southwest Alaska. Those are geothermal springs. They run roughly from Ophir or Tatlewiksik on the northeast down to about Ophir. You also see a cluster, it's kind of buried by other symbols, in southeastern Alaska. And then there are some hot springs that are scattered along the Aleutian volcanic chain, but they're kind of buried under the volcano symbols. The point is there are 97 what we refer to as geothermal sites scattered around the state, and many of these you see through these spring symbols. At 5 of these sites, we have a pretty advanced understanding of the system. Makushin Volcano, Akutan, Spur, Pilgrim Hot Springs out on the Seward Peninsula in China, okay? And only China's producing, okay? So we have 92 sites that we really don't know anything about. We have a water temperature. We may have a flow rate at the spring. We may have some geochemistry on the water, but that's all we know. We don't know the size of the system that's heating that water. And so that's important to remember. And so you see these sites scattered widely across the state that really suggests that geothermal energy potential is widespread throughout the state. But we just don't know. If there are no questions.
Thank you. Please continue.
So this is just a depth temperature plot. Depth is on the vertical axis. Temperature is on the horizontal axis. You got temperature in Fahrenheit at the top, temperature in centigrade on the bottom, depth in feet on the left, depth in kilometers on the right. And just for reference, we have the temperature of the water at about 2,000 feet depth at Makushan Volcano, and it's slightly warmer than about 380 degrees, so that's a high temperature system. And for comparison, you see the temperature plotted for China. That's maybe a little more than 160 degrees Fahrenheit at a depth of roughly 1,000 feet. So just two different systems, two different water temperatures, just to give you an idea of what's out there. We don't know at depth where any of these other sites, these other 92 sites, we don't know where they plot in that depth temperature space. So just underscoring what we don't know. I'll go further if there are no questions.
I don't see any questions. Please continue.
Okay, thank you.
I think everybody's wheels are turning, just taking it all in. Thank you.
Well, I'm hoping I'm not putting anyone to sleep.
Oh, no.
Okay, good. So here, just kind of summarizing, generation capacity per unit cost depends on several geologic and economic factors. Temperature, obviously hotter is better. Flow rate, higher flow rates are better for conventional hydrothermal power. The reservoir framework, if you have uniform porosity, that's better than fractures. But in a lot of these systems, you're going to be dealing with igneous rocks. They tend not to be porous, and you're going to be dealing with fractures. But as a general statement, that is true. Uniform porosity is better. Recharge, partially natural recharge is better than artificial. But like I said a few slides back, if you've got hot, dry rocks, you can pump water into those hot, dry rocks, heat the water, and then produce the water. Depth, shallower is better because it costs money to drill wells. And location, it's better if you have the resource close to a population, but I will refer back to that heat flow map, and you see a lot of those hot springs that are well removed from the road system, and one might ask, well, if you've got a resource out there, who cares? You know, you're 200 miles from, you know, the Elliott Highway, or you're 200 miles from the nearest road or whatever. That's a valid question, but until you know what you've got out there, you can't write it off. You can't say that's too far away. You can't say that that's too remote because, you know, maybe there's a village of 100 people or 200 people 20 miles away from it, and that resource could really change their lives. So if there are no questions.
Please continue. I do agree with your comment with 158-plus microgrids in rural Alaska. I see a lot of white spots on there that could be where a guy could potentially tie two or three villages together.
Yes, yes.
If we knew what we knew.
Yes. And if you had a large system out there, maybe it would power a 30-megawatt system or larger. Who knows?
Thank you.
So this is my last slide of the five. And just to summarize, geothermal heat, where technically and economically accessible, is an excellent form of sustainable energy. Hydrothermal systems are the most common form of energy extraction from geothermal heat, but like I said, there are other ways to do it. Complex geologic parameters are necessary for a viable geothermal resource. All present at one location is probably rare. Alaska contains several potential geothermal resources, and that heat flow map, I hope that kind of conveyed that point. And this is probably the most important of the bullets, the last one here. The technology in this space is rapidly advancing. And so what we have today is going to be very different than, say, 5 years from now or 10 years from now. So a resource that might be marginal for a commercial hydrothermal power system in 10 years, maybe it won't be marginal. A system that might be marginal in terms of providing energy for a village of 200 people, in 10 years it might not be marginal because the technology might be there to do something with it. That's all I have in the five slides.
Thank you, Dr. LePine.
Chair Bishop, John Crowther for the record here. I think we would like to present the supplemental slides at the end of the deck. I do believe Chair Huber from the AOGCC is online and may want to provide some clarifying comments to the committee about the different delineations and requirements for permitting for wells associated with geothermal if he is on the line.
Mr. Huber, can you hear us?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman, I can.
You have some qualifying statements you'd like to make?
Mr. Chairman, not necessarily qualifying statements, but there was some discussion about the Class 5 and the interaction with Class 5 with geothermal. And I think it's important to note that Class 5 is only necessary for the injection portion of the wells. So under our current authority, AOGCC can permit to drill for exploratory wells, for delineation wells, for stratigraphy wells. So we have the current authority to do that, and our turnaround time for those permits is directed in statute to be as quick as practicable, and I can tell you that we're turning around permits to drill in about 2 weeks.
All right, very good. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Well, Chair Bishop, our supplemental slides begin on slide 29 of the deck, so we'll advance. One second, Chair. Apologies.
We'll take a brief of these. Okay, we're back on the record, Deputy Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair. We'll have Dr. LePine go through these additional kind of detailed maps of the different sites that have been referenced.
Thank you, Dr. LePine.
Hey, for the record, my name is David LePine, DGGS. I don't know if I have to do the whole introduction.
Please, just okay. As we got two male presenters, just to keep our Senate records.
Sure, okay.
Identified for record keeping.
Understood. Yeah, my name is David LePine. I'm the director of the DNR Division of Geological and Geophysical Surveys. In that role, I'm also the Alaska State Geologist. So this slide here is essentially showing the geothermal sites that I showed on that heat flow map, but you can actually see where all the sites are here. And so we define two broadly classed systems here. We have granite-hosted or granite-related systems, and we have volcano-related systems. The volcano-related systems are obviously located in the Aleutian Arc and then come up the Alaska Peninsula and then up along the west side of Cook Inlet Basin. The granite-related systems, there are three of them. We have that east-west trending system going from the Seward Peninsula over to at least Circle and Central Hot Springs. We have another one in southwest Alaska from at least Ophir, or Tatlowiksik in the northeast to Ophir. And then we have one in southeast Alaska near where we're sitting today. And so there are these large granitic bodies that have been intruded at depth up into shallower crustal depths, 300 or 3,000 feet, 4,000 feet, 5,000 feet. Some of them are actually at the surface. Erosion has essentially exposed them. And these are generally, 70, 80, 90, 100 million years old. So these are pretty old, in terms of last week and last month. But the Earth is a very effective insulator. And so they've been cooling for long periods of time, and they're still really, really hot. So that's where the hot water's coming from, in the granite-related systems. And so in the volcano-related systems, obviously you have these volcanoes are related to large-scale subduction. Pacific crust is subducting under south-central Alaska. And you're essentially generating magma in that process. Magma rises up, creates these volcanoes. So there's a lot of heat in these volcano-related systems as well. So those are the two broadly defined systems. And this just shows a little more granularity as far as where they're distributed. And the next series of slides is just going to window in on each area. And you'll actually see some of these springs. You'll see the spring names. You'll probably recognize a lot of them. So if there are no questions, I'll go farther.
Please continue.
So this is geothermal systems in the Fairbanks region. You can see they're classified by spring temperature, by water temperature. High temperature hot springs, and warm springs. And you can see a lot of warm springs, a lot of hot springs. I'm not sure, I don't see a high temperature spring here, but they're widely distributed, and these are all granite related. And so many of these, as you'll note, are off the road system, but there are villages nearby: Rampart, Tanana, Manly Hot Springs, Hughes, Alicaca. And so like I say, these are widespread and they're granite related. Pause for questions or advance.
Please continue.
Thank you. So shifting to the western end of that trend, that granite related trend, we've got the Seward Peninsula here. We got Pilgrim Hot Spring. We have Serpentine Lava Creek. Serpentine is a high temperature hot spring. Pilgrim, Lava Creek, those are hot springs. And so we see these distributed, and we see Koyukuk or Koyuk, Gullivan, Elim, Nome. We've got Kotzebue to the north. And so we don't really know a lot about these systems except Pilgrim. And so we don't know, I guess, what we don't know about these systems. Pause for questions. So moving down onto the Alaska Peninsula, these are the volcano related systems. You can see the Alaska Peninsula there and the eastern part of the Aleutian Chain. You see Makushan Volcano there towards the lower left. You see Hot Springs Cove, Portoff Cove, Akutan. These are high temperature hot springs. And as you all know, Makushan is in the process of being developed right now. A lot of work has been done at Akutan. I mentioned Akutan is one of the five, Makushan and Akutan. A fair amount of work has been done at Akutan. But to my knowledge, nobody is moving forward to develop that resource. But again, just want to show these are widely distributed along the chain, extending up into the upper part of the Alaska Peninsula. And for most of them, except for Akutan and Makushan, we don't know a lot about them. Pause for questions.
Please continue.
This is, I think, the last slide. This is southeast Alaska. You can see there's two high temperature hot springs, Bailey Bay and Tenneke Inlet. We have a number of that's a high temperature. Those are two high temperature springs. Excuse me. Then we have a number of warm springs and a few hot springs scattered around. These are all granite related. And again, we don't know much about these at all. There has been no advanced exploratory work done at these sites. And so we just don't know much other than water temperature coming out of a spring. We have a spring flow rate maybe, and we might have some chemistry on the water. That's all we know. So the point of these slides is just to really hit home how widespread the geothermal resource potential is in the state. And in my mind, it's wide open because we know so little about it. And there could be some real significant sites out there that could be very important as far as providing renewable energy going forward. It could be a big deal for some of these remote villages. That's all I have.
Dr. Lapina, I have a question.
Sure.
You had made a comment earlier that Nevada has been producing power from geothermal resources for a period of years. Can you give me a little more detail to the committee? Megawatt size, how long they've been producing, et cetera.
I can get back to the committee with details on geothermal production in Nevada. Mm-hmm. They have been producing energy for decades, as I said. I don't know how long. I don't know how many power systems they have. I know they have several, and I know they're up in the 10, 20, 30 megawatt range. These are not small systems. There may be some even larger than 30 megawatts. And I mentioned Nevada, but California also produces electricity from geothermal power. I believe Idaho does. I'm not sure about Utah, but I will get that information to the committee. I'll find out how long Nevada has been producing power, and I'll get a listing of the sites and the size of the power plants for the committee.
Thank you. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just really briefly, I'll say thank you for this presentation. It's really interesting.
You're welcome.
I'm glad we're getting into more of it. It is actually sort of striking on these maps. It almost seems like the geothermal resources are where the people aren't. And it's the case in the broader map. It happens to be the biggest gap is sort of around the Anchorage area in Mat-Su. And it makes you think about maybe human beings didn't, for some reason, want to live next to volcanoes. Or, although those are granite early. I don't know. Maybe it's just an accident of history. But it does seem like they're in more remote areas. Doesn't mean they can't be useful, as you said, for villages and also some commercial properties. The one out on the Aleutians, is that associated with the large fish processing plant out there? That's one question. And then, you know, are there mines that are exploring these as, you know, potential power sources? And I guess my last question is, you know, what's the ownership, the land ownership in a lot of them? We're going to hear from someone who I assume it's privately owned land. But, for example, if there is a resource that's on a federal land, how difficult is it going to be to access that resource?
That is a very good question, Senator Dunbar, through the chair. If you look at that central belt running east-west from the Seward Peninsula to nearly the Canadian border, there's a lot of federal land in that area. Some of those sites are going to be on federal land. I know some of those sites are on federal land, but not all of them. As far as difficulty in developing them, I just don't know. I know there will be hurdles that have to be cleared. Perhaps Deputy Commissioner Crowther can comment on that, but I just don't know. But I do know that some of those sites are on federal land, and so there will be some challenges there.
Brief follow-up, Mr. Chair. Just I asked a series of questions. So the one that you didn't answer was about commercial users or large industrial users, like mines or fish processing plants.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that. Senator Dunbar, through the chair. I believe Mr. Carl can speak to this better than I can, but the project that's underway at Makuchin Volcano, I believe that will provide power for the city of Unalaska, but there's also a fish processor in that area, and I believe that's part of the plan. But as I said, Mr. Carl can speak to that far better than I can. But I believe that's part of the reason for the development activity out there. You know, just to add, we were talking earlier today, Donlin is a world-class gold resource, and that one of the reasons that has not gone forward faster is you need a lot of electricity to process the ore, to mine it, and where do you get the electricity at the location that Donlin's at? So a geothermal plant in the area could really be a game changer for Donlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
All right. Closing comments?
Thank you, Chair Bishop. John Crowther here. I think we really appreciate the committee's time. We'll be coming before the committee again to do the detailed review of the bill and the sectional analysis. Look forward to that presentation, and I don't think anything further this time.
Yeah, I apologize. I didn't recognize Deputy Commissioner Goodrum in the back of the room, but the department's been well represented here today. We appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
All right, we're going to take a brief at ease while we set up our next presentation. On the record, now you can we'll have somebody help you advance.
Well, here's the deal. First of all,
please put yourself on the record.
Oh, excuse me. Bernie Carl, Fairbanks, Alaska. Been here 50 years this year, and you couldn't run me out of here with a shitty stick. I was born an American, but I'm an Alaskan by choice. I don't like it here. I love it here. And I don't need to do anything in life. I'm at the age you don't have to do things, but I'm doing things because God's given me 50 more years of life and good health, and I'm on a mission. I'm on a mission to make the world a better place to live, and we're going to do that. And we're going to do that in geothermal. If we harness 2%, well, excuse me, I guess I'm supposed to say, Mr. Chairman, Co-Chair Bishop, Co-Chair Giesel, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. Please forgive me. This isn't what I do for a living. But anyway, it's what I'm doing today. So if we harness 2% of the Earth's energy, that is 1,000 times more than the world consumes. Do you want to know why we don't do it? You want to know why we don't do that? Because we're addicted to oil in one arm, and we're addicted to greed in the other. We shouldn't be burning C1 through C6 and burning our oil like a bunch of drunken sailors. We should be, Alaska should lead the parade in building the building blocks for the world. The highest and best paid jobs should all be in Alaska, not anywhere else. They should be here. We should be turning out the workforce for taking all of these elements and turning them into something else that we export. It's insane what we do. We want to just burn everything and put all the emissions up in the air. Total insanity. You want to do something that's good for this state, do something good for the world? Then let's just be responsible with the resources we have. You do not have to be the brightest bulb on the tree. You just got to be a bulb, not the brightest one. And that bulb can be, it can be lit with geothermal energy. Yeah, that's how we'll light these bulbs, and lots of them. So that brings me to, you know, we got a bunch of slides, but the state did such a good job. I think we're gonna. I got to get to the next slide here somewhere. What button do you push here? And then I'll be on top of this. Okay. I got to start that again. Yeah, we're gonna watch the video right now. They're gonna be a lot smarter. We actually put this video together, and it's very informative.
You might recognize the voice on it.
Majestic landscapes of the Aleutians bring us inspiration and connection. Inspiration for the future potential in our communities and a connection to the bounty and geography of this land. But how do we create sustainability? Sustainable communities today have three pillars: economic security, ecological integrity, and social well-being. Those with a plan are most nimble to respond to the demands of global markets, technology, public policy, and climate. Unalaska is globally significant for its natural resources and its ocean pathway for cargo and people. So what if we created yet another significant reason to do business in and through Unalaska? Imagine a reliable and abundant source of clean energy and the economic possibilities that result. What if Makushin Volcano was tapped for its geothermal energy? We know that geothermal energy is an economic engine. It's proven. We've proven it. Renewable energy meets the green initiative goals of most companies and their capital investments going forward. Geothermal stimulates what previously was not economically viable. It makes year-round commercial greenhouses viable for local and surrounding industry distribution and consumption. It makes recreational hot spring. It makes showcasing of geothermal-based manufacturing a complement to a thriving tourism industry. It makes recycling, commercial dehydration, and future processing of Unalaska's bounty of seafood and medicinal plants economically viable. It makes alternative energy possible for transport, including public transport, electric vehicles, hybrid fishing vessels, and not too far in the future, cargo ships and airplanes. Demand for reducing one's carbon footprint and drawing down carbon will only increase opportunities for individuals, companies, and communities. Leadership in these initiatives has the potential to bring global attention for environmental programs and investment in the form of case studies, pilot projects, and collaborations. Mimic what nature is doing. Nature has no waste. God only created one mammal that deliberately destroys his environment and then denies it. I'm talking to us, man. But look at the opportunities with no waste. This involves reusing and recycling products and materials and employing regenerative natural systems. Dutch Harbor will be the first place in Alaska with zero waste, zero emissions, all from geothermal. Why is this important to UnAlaska? Because the food, transport, and tourism industries are adapting their business models around these new zero-waste systems. It is not a trend. It is a movement with scorecards published to their stockholders, customers, and community at large. Geothermal can be adapted for use in home heating systems with the potential to reduce air emissions. Geothermal energy can support a community growing its own nutrient-dense food, key to preventing and healing of chronic disease. Greenhouses serve a broad range of constituents and can be used as an educational platform, a social gathering place, a mental health retreat, or a center for food as medicine program. Students and classes can use it as a dynamic learning center for nearly every course in their curriculum, as well as special summer programs. Geothermal can serve as a trademark of our sustainable community and support a higher quality of life. UnAlaska offers us bounty in the form of abundant oceans, lands, and energy. It is our home to make into a community where we want to live, the next generation to thrive, and the legacy of our collective vision. And we must decide on a sustainable path forward.
So how many people here have been out to UnAlaska Dutch Harbor? Two, three. Well, I invite the rest of you to come and be our guest. Take a tour, let us show you around, let you believe in what the future has. How do you get the next slide? There's this button here. Oh, wait a minute. I just played the movie. How do we get out of that? Oh, thank you. Okay, so there's some of these slides we're going to go over real quick because the state kind of already went over that. And then I can just do what I want to do, right?
To a point.
I mean, with much respect. Yes. Yeah. Anyway, so we talked about geothermal. The state is a warehouse of geothermal. And what you don't know, I think Vice Chair, you said, Vice Chair Bishop, you did say what you don't know, you don't know. But let me tell you what we do know. We do know that we can take a water sample anywhere and everywhere. And that's something that we ought to do. You take the water sample, and that geochemistry of that water will tell you what the geothermometer is. It's not wackadoodle. It's just straight science. I mean, we could actually have this. This is a simple thing to do. And we don't have to do the test. We can send them to Southern Methodist University, and they'll tell us exactly. They'll tell us exactly what's in that water. So why would we want to do that? Then we'll know. We don't have to drill a hole. We don't have to do anything. We just go take water samples. It would be a great project for some summer interns up at the university to go take samples. Take samples of every hot springs in the state of Alaska, the ones that haven't been done. And then let's just see what's there. That's how simple that is. And I bet you DNR's got money in their budget to do that. Don't you, DNR? You don't have to answer. But I'm just saying, that's something that's simple that can be done. And that's what we've done. And that's why we know what's in our water. It's not hocus pocus. It's not witchcraft. It's pretty simple to understand. He already talked about the major regions. And this heat flow map was done by Dr. David Blackwell from Southern Methodist University and Dr. Tester. He was at MIT. He's now up at Cornell. They put the heat flow map together for Alaska, for the United States, and they've done one now for the world. These two guys are clever characters. And Dr. Joe Baltar, he did his PhD on the heat flow map for Alaska, and he was our intern for 2 years. So we housed and fed him and took care of him so he could go around and test every well he could find in Alaska. He did a good job. And that was just done in the last few years, and he became a PhD on that. A clever young man. How much geothermal resources? How much? Well, there's enough to run the world. Alaska is a great place. We have more geothermal here than anywhere in the world. Why? Because we have the Ring of Fire, and there's 60 volcanoes out there, and they should all be looked at. It's not a big deal. Just go take the water samples. Chena Hot Springs, it's the lowest temperature electricity being produced in the world at 165 degrees. It is the model for all of these small places in the United States and all the small places in Alaska. You don't have to spend the most money to make it work. What you have to do is see what you have. And as a, for instance, at Pilgrim Hot Springs, they're going to be up at Chena Hot Springs here the 16th of next month. They're bringing a whole tour to come up because they want to do something at Pilgrim. But what happened at Pilgrim, they had five wells that were producing 210 degree water, doing a great job. So what do? We go up there and spend $11 million, drill a new hole, leave the drill steel in the hole, and plug off all them wells. And they could have produced enough electricity out of those wells to grow all the food for Western Alaska. But anyway, we plugged and abandoned them. Now we got to go up there and spend a bunch of money to re-drill something that they're going to get the same results. Anyway, with that being said, let's don't worry about what we've already done. They want to do something up there, and they should do it. It's right there, and they can grow all the food, make the electricity, and grow all the food for Western Alaska in one spot. And they should do that. So Chena Hot Springs, we not only just make our electricity, we heat 58 buildings, and that saves about $680,000 a year. We grow the food, and we're getting really good. Our tomatoes this year, they're over 2 years old. Now, I know that sounds, you can't find anybody that's doing it, but what I did is I took, when the plants were 100 feet long, I took and cut them with a razor blade, and I re-rooted them at 6 feet. And then as soon as they had good roots, I cut off the rest of the plant. And now I got a new plant with five braces of tomatoes, and it's blooming. I believe these tomatoes will live to be 300, 400, 500 years old. They're a hybrid seed, and I bought them for $2.50 a piece from Holland. And when I told the people and the Dutch people what I was doing, they said, well, that won't work. I said, well, but it is working. They said, well, what do you mean? I said, well, if your aunt had balls, she'd have been your uncle. It's working. You know, I mean, they has all these tomatoes. So you can't say that it's not working. So I sent them all the pictures. They said, well, you're the only person we know doing it. Well, I might be the only person doing it, but it's going to change the way you grow food. And you're going to grow lots of it. And you only have to plant the plant once. It's amazing. And to go out there and see all that fruit that you produce 365 days a year. We have the highest temperature swing greenhouse in the world. And the most productive greenhouse in the world. That doesn't come from Bernie Carl. That comes from the Greenhouse Growers Conference from 75 countries that spent 4 days. The people that write the books, I only read them. So, with that being said, the opportunity for us, the second phase of Unalaska Dutch Harbor, is 40 acres of greenhouses, turning out 240,000 pounds of food every day. Dutch greenhouses cost $80 million to put them in. That's a good buy, $80 million for 40 acres of greenhouses. And we've proven everything at Chena Hot Springs. We don't have to reprove things. We know we can do it. Can you imagine 240,000 pounds of food harvested daily? That is the food security. You hear a lot of people talking about food security. Well, we will become the food security for Alaska. 240,000 pounds of food each and every day. And it's going to employ a lot of people. 200 new jobs. Well-paid jobs. So I think there's lots of possibilities. Everything will be delivered with cyber-wing drones that haul 10,000 pounds. They'll go up to 22,000 feet, fly at 600 miles an hour, and deliver food all over Alaska. And that's the future. So we understand the future. And, there will be a hot springs there. Why? Because there's water, hot water, running down this river at about 3,000 feet up on the side of the volcano. There's water running out of the volcano. And it's hot. And it's just cascading down the river. So why not put some beautiful hot springs in? They have 32 cruise ships going to go there this year. Well, wouldn't you like to come to the most beautiful place in the world and have a whole hot springs of river coming down that you could use? Well, I think so. So why not develop that? That's got to be one of the phases, right? They talked about Southeast. There's lots of water all over the state, and we can develop every bit of that. So we don't need to really go into what there is in other places in Southeast. The Aleutian Islands are what we want to talk about. Because right now, we have a 3-inch hole that's drilled there. And that hole is putting out 63,000 pounds of steam an hour at 395 degrees at 60 psi. It ran for 34 days and no drawdown at the surface at all. 2 psi at the bottom of the hole, which is negligible. So if you look at the PI of that well, if that well was a 13.3H well, which we're going to drill, that'll put out 2 million pounds of steam an hour. And we've already signed, we have a power purchase agreement with the city of Boone, Alaska to buy 30 megawatts of power. We're selling them that power for 16.3 cents. The price of power in Boone, Alaska today is 45 cents. We are going to get that lower. We think that eventually we'll get that price down to 8 cents by looking at putting more people online and by looking at some other proposals of money that's available nowadays. We hope we can get some of the grant money, put it in this, and any grant dollar we put in, we're going to lower the price of electricity to 4,500 residents and lower the price of electricity. Any additional funds that come in, we just lower the price. So then everybody gets to share. It's not like somebody is trying to grab the money. Also, at that site, we have 7,000 acres of patented ground and own the resource. We put all that together. And all the ground around us belongs to the OC Native Corporation. Now, how does this work? Well, it's called OCCP. OC, the Native Corporation, owns 51%. CP, which is Chena Power, it's an ESOP owned by 138 employees, has 49%. My wife died. God wanted her in heaven, so he blessed her with ALS. And then halfway through ALS, he blessed her with stage 4 pancreatic cancer. He decided he wanted my wife in heaven, so he granted me with the ability to care for her. She never spent one day, not one day in a hospital, not one day in a home, not one day in her bed. Every day, God blessed me with the ability to give her a bath and massage her feet with coconut oil, massage her legs, and I'd massage her butt, and she would just coo like a morning dove. I would dress her and take her to work. We'd get there at 9 o'clock in the morning. We just started working half a day, 9 in the morning till 9 at night. And no more of that 18, 20 hours. I could make her laugh at any moment. The doctor gave me 64 ounces of morphine and 2 syringes. Instead of his wife, he would give her 20 milligrams of morphine every 4 hours. If you do that, you're going to kill somebody. She didn't want to die. I know the power of prayer. I know the power of God's love. When she was in pain, I would put my hand on her head, and in 20 seconds, she'd be out of pain. She lived 29 more weeks, got to see her grandkids 4 more times. She got to die in her home, in her bed with her husband, with no pain, no drugs, and went to heaven. So don't you all wish we could die that way? So we turned this into an ESOP, and so it's owned by the employees. My wife died with zero net worth. I'm going to die with zero net worth, and all of that money stays in this state. Everything that we've ever made, everything that we could ever borrow, everything that we could ever do, we spend in this state. We're not taking anything with us. My wife took nothing with her. So she loved this project. She died before this project ever got to be finished. But it will get done because I'm driven to do it. I'm driven for this project to get it done. And we have good partners. And we have some of the brightest people in the world working for us. We are in a perfect location. I mean a perfect location. Our geophysicist tells me we can make 450 megawatts of power off of this 7,000 acres. U.S. for 400, 500 years. USGS says we can make 1,000 megawatts for 1,000 years. Who cares? I mean, for 500 years, we are going to look after Unalaska Dutch Harbor for the next 500 years. Do you realize that 60% of all fish consumed in America comes from one place, Unalaska Dutch Harbor? There's 174,000 containers move that through that port a year. It's the only international port we have in Alaska. And I don't think the average person realizes how important this is. 2 million metric tons of fish has been taken out of the Bering Sea for 40 years. It is sustainable. It is the most sustainable fishery in the world. I really give a lot of credit to the state of Alaska and more credit to the fishermen because there's a lot of smart fishermen to care. The three main fishing people in the world are in Unalaska Dutch Harbor and the fish processors. It's the biggest one out there right now is Trident. They're getting ready to move their plant. They're going to spend $500 million of their family's money. They're moving there to get geothermal energy. He's building for another 50 years. We're building for 50 years. So it matches up. And then one of the oldest geothermal plants in the world is over in Italy, the first one. It's been running since 1903. So there's no time date on when you have to quit. This is going to be going on forever. Our proximity is close to Japan. We have 4,774 ships come within 12 miles of Unalaska Dutch Harbor on the Great Circle Route. And that's what gives this that's what makes this so important. Oh, that's the wrong thing. Excuse me. Project location. We're halfway out the Aleutian Chain, and it's a long ways from here. It is 1,200 nautical miles from Fairbanks, 900 nautical miles from Anchorage. Our power plant is 14 miles away from town. So we have, we have 2.5 miles of access, utility access right away. We're not allowed to build a road. This project is all permitted, but it's not a road. It kind of looks like a road, but we're not permitted for a road. And the bridges kind of look like a bridge, but they're not bridges. And the reason for that is we were able to get that under the national permit. So, to have this project all permitted to me is a true blessing. Some people say how hard it is to get things permitted. I think we were very successful. We were able to permit this project in 7 months. And I don't think that's too outlandish. I thought it should have been done in 30 days, but I had to accept a few little pitfalls. Anyway, the power plant is on this plateau, a 350-acre plateau. And we have, like I say, 2.5 miles of access built now. We're actually going to go back to work at the end of this month and finish the access. My help tells me, this is how sure my help is of this project. They told me that if they're not up on that plateau by Christmas Eve, I don't have to pay them. And they're all getting Davis-Bacon wages. And they said, if we're not there, just don't pay us. That's how sure we are of the project. They walked the whole route. And they are prepared to put that commitment. How many people have employees that are willing to put their entire time in, and if they don't complete the project on time, they give them no money? That's pretty interesting. I don't know too many other crews that want to do that. We have 14 miles of a power line to put in, and 4.5 miles of the subsea up to 300 feet deep, and that has all been surveyed. All the bathymetry reports are done. It was $350,000. That's all completed. All this stuff is done. Our vision for the future, I mean, we're going to first do the Makushan volcano, but that's just the start of it. And then we're going to move to ADA because we're going to have the drill rigs, the Connie May 1, the Connie May 2. We can move all the equipment down. There's a well drilled down there that was drilled in the 60s. It shows we can make 25 megawatts of power at ADA. So why wouldn't we do that? Here's a community that's burning diesel fuel. Why wouldn't we want to help them? We want to help them. We want to help everybody. Anybody that wants to do something with geothermal, we want to share this knowledge. We don't keep it for ourselves. We want to share it. And so there's more power out in the Aleutians than all of America needs. But there's no people. So why don't we turn it into things that we can turn it into? Why don't we, instead of smelting all of this ore in places where they pollute the earth, why don't we do what Iceland does? Iceland has an aluminum smelter there from Alcoa. They bring all of that bauxite ore, think about what I'm telling you, from Australia, 3/4 of the way around the world, they bring it to Iceland. Why do they do that? Because of less than 2 cent power. That's why. That's why, less than 2 cent power. And so how do they get that power? And they don't get it from geothermal, by the way. They have the largest, they have a 780 megawatt hydroelectric project. Only 20% of their country is on geothermal. It's a misnomer. They think they're all on, that's not true. They're all on renewables, but most of it is hydroelectric, of which Alaska is a leader in hydroelectric. If you want to look at renewables, that's where we lead here too. Alaska has the potential to burn no diesel fuel. We have that potential, and we should use that diesel fuel for building the future, and we should use our natural gas for building the future. So we should do everything from renewables. We should lead this parade. Alaska should lead the parade. America used to lead. We're not even in the parade anymore. So why don't Alaska just take the place of America and lead? Why don't we just do that? Let the other people follow us. I mean, I'm not oversimplifying it because it's that simple. So this is what we can do over at Unalaska Dutch Harbor. We can finish that. And when we're done and you have all of these other things happening right now at Chena Hot Springs on August the 13th, we're opening up a little manufacturing plant. Right now, I buy 900 light items that I sell in a gift shop, two gift shops. I buy it from China. I buy it from India. I buy it from Pakistan. And I buy it from Vietnam. We have 10 laser jet printers, 10 laser jet cutters, and we made this. And this says Alaska, and it says Chena Hot Springs, and it says made with love. But now it's going to say made with love from above, so you give it the credit to God. Chena Hot Springs, Alaska, and it's got a barcode. Why are we doing this? Because the tourists, when they come to Alaska, they have this, it's a trip of a lifetime, and they're so happy. Oh, my gosh, they're just happy of all the beauty and everything they get to see and experience. And then they come to your gift shop, and they pick up the little thing they want to take home. And they're excited, and they turn it over, and it says, made in China. I tell you, you just it's like being sucker punched. It says made in China or made in India. It's hard to find anything. I just went through several gift shops here in Juneau, and I'm going to tell you, it's no different in Juneau than it is in Chena Hot Springs, Alaska. The difference is that twice a day, you get to watch all this stuff being manufactured. From the time you come there, if we take a picture of you and you want a T-shirt or you want a sweatshirt, it'll be made in America, and we'll print whatever you want on it right there in front of you, and then you get to take it home. This is a Christmas ornament. This was all cut with a laser. That was done in a matter of minutes. We're going to use all Alaskan birch, all Alaskan woods. We're not even going to buy the wood from outside. We're going to sell everything made in Alaska, made with love from above. And then when we're successful, which we will be, how about 40 acres of manufacturing over in Unalaska, Dutch Harbor from geothermal energy? How about we fill up another 100,000 containers a year and we ship it to America? How about we sell all these products that we're buying from China, India, Pakistan? How about we make them in Alaska? How about we put Alaska first? How about we help America by helping Alaska? Why don't we become the center for making things? We just bought $140,000 worth of carbon fiber. You know, and it comes in 4-pound rolls, 4.2-pound rolls. And right now I am printing an impeller for a pump that I can't buy. Carbon is 10 times stronger than steel, 10 times lighter than aluminum. And you know what we should do? I bought this carbon. You know where it came from? It came from, of all places, it came from Japan. Let me tell you how smart Japan is. They bought our CH4 LNG for 40 years. They took it to Japan. They took out the hydrogen and burned it in their turbines. And when they burn the hydrogen, it gives water, and they use the water. They took the carbon out. They make carbon fiber, and they sold it all back to America. They sold it back to us. Where do you think a 787 comes from? It comes from Japan. They build the fuselage. They build the wings out of carbon that we sold them. They're way smarter than us. So why don't we just take one of their pages out of their playbook? We don't have to be the brightest bulb in the tree. So I'm going to say thank you. I really appreciate your time, and I would like to answer any and every question you have.
James Kaufman, Senator Kaufman, has a question.
Thank you, through the chair, to Mr. Carl. Thank you for your testimony. A very interesting presentation and a subject matter that I love. I'm curious about your lower temperature energy generation at Chena. So the mechanism, I wouldn't think you're driving a steam turbine, so Stirling cycle engines. How do you convert heat into electrical power?
Senator Kaufman, through the chair, we use, or so am I supposed to say through the chair?
Just keep going.
Okay, sorry, I'll get it right next time. Anyway, I apologize for that. Anyway, that's a good question. We use an organic Rankine cycle, so it's the opposite of a refrigeration cycle. So when you have 165 degree water, water boils at 212, right? So how are you going to get that energy out of that low temperature water? We heat up two different mediums. In turbines, we heat up one 134 FA refrigerant, and it boils at 59 degrees. And we take that up to 200 PSI of pressure, and it spins the turbine. It takes its first pressure drop, and we start cooling it down. You can cool it with air. You can cool it with water, and you turn it back to a liquid, and then you start the vapor phase over again. We have the first synchronous screw expander in the world. It comes from Kashan out of China. It's spinning at 1,800 RPM. It's the first synchronous screw generator in the world, serial number one. It goes to 1,800 RPM, and we're heating up 245 FA. It's a refrigerant that oil also boils at 59 degrees, but you can take it to a higher temperature, so it's a little more efficient. Higher PSI, so it's a little more efficient. So we're using two different types of refrigerant. over in Unalaska Dutch Harbor, we're actually doing the same thing. We're not using the steam. Our flow out of that well is 12% steam. The rest is hot water at 395 degrees. So we're not going to – we want to use the water and the steam. And what Ormat has done, we've signed an EPC contract with Ormat. They have 3,000 megawatts of geothermal power. They put it in the world in 65 countries. They're Israelis. They have 1,000 megawatts of power in America that they own, run, and manage. 60% of their factory, what comes out of the factory, they sell to themselves. 40% they sell to people like me. We signed an EPC contract on the 17th day of January this year for $90 million. And we're doing the same thing with them. They are taking their entire flow of steam and hot water. It's going through the heat exchanger, and it's going to heat up isopentane. And that's C2 if you look at the carbon chain, C1 through C6. That's isopentane. It's cheap. It's inexpensive. Way cheaper than these refrigerants I'm talking about. They sell those by the pound. The other stuff I'm talking about, you buy by the gallon. So there's a lot of difference in price. Like in our case, it'll be $1 million difference in price. So, and that's big. So, but it's the same philosophy. It's an organic Rankine cycle. And instead of cooling with water, we're going to cool with air. Because we're on a plateau over there, and the average temperature in Unalaska Dutch Harbor year-round is 47 degrees. So it's going to really work well. Our project, every bit of the water is getting reinjected. So we have a plateau, a 350-acre plateau. We have the production wells. We're going to drill three. We think we can only need two. We bought our own drill rig. So we have a top-drive drill rig that'll drill 10,000 feet in directional drill. We only have to go 2,000 feet. And that's not very deep. 2,000 feet is not much with a 13 3/8-inch casing. And when that steam comes up, it's going to go through the plant, both as steam and water. It's called two phases, so that multi-phase. And it's going to go through the heat exchanger. And then we are going to put it, we're not going to take it any colder. We're never going to be below 180 degrees. And why do we do that? Well, because we've had all of the sampling's been done. If you take it down below 180 degrees, we're going to have problems in the well plugging the wells up because the minerals mostly they precipitate out, and then you have a problem. And we're going to be managing that very closely. So we're not going to get below 180 degrees, and we're always going to put a little surfactant in there to help. It's a normal thing to do. We have that all factored into our cost. So we're going to put that. We're going to take care of our wells so you don't have to be messing with them. They're going to be setting 1,100 feet. So here's a plateau, and the injection wells are sitting 1,100 feet down from that. And why is that? Well, because now you don't need a pump. No parasitic load. All of that is going to go right back down in the well, and we have no parasitic load. You don't have to be the brightest bulb. All you got to do is actually just go walk it, look it over, and you'll get all kinds of great ideas. Because nature will teach you everything. You see how the water's running down off these? Oh, that's a good idea. You don't have to be too bright. Just watch what the waterfalls are doing. They're going downhill, and they go down the river. That's basically what we're doing. We're having a waterfall, and it's going to go right back down the hole. And so there'll be no discharge of any kind. Think about that. Zero emissions of any kind. You want to talk about being carbon neutral. This project will be the poster child for the world. It will be the poster child for the world, where everything's accounted for.
Follow-up. Then Senator Giesel. Oh, excuse me, Mr. Dunbar, and then Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Carl. What has the permitting been like for the Michigan project? Is it state, federal? About how long has it taken? How long have you got?
It took us 7 months to get our permits through the Corps of Engineers. It took about a year to get the permits through Fish and Game. But they were all excellent to deal with. I didn't even have an inconvenience. But I think a lot of it has to do with the way you look at things. First of all, you have to understand that every one of these people that works in government, the safe answer is no. So they're going to tell you no, and I don't care who it is. They're going to tell you no. So then you have to really think about how can you help them say yes. So if you have that attitude, then you won't have a problem. I've never had a problem in my life. So when I deal with these rascals, I don't have any problems because I know that they're challenged. You know, they have to say no. You know, so all I have to do is figure out
how they can say yes. And that's way better. And the way you do that is the first thing, you don't antagonize them. And please don't take this wrong, but I didn't have an attorney do it, so then I got to talk directly.
There's three on this committee. No. So just for FYI.
Well, you asked. I'm sorry, sir, but Senator Dunbar, you asked, so I.
No, I'm just
brief follow-up, Mr. Chair. So the Corps of Engineers, Fish and Game. So the EPA and DEC weren't otherwise.
Well, DEC, the only thing we had permits for DEC with was the camp, and they were for drinking water, and they were a gem to work with. We worked with DEC a lot in the past. No problems there. We're gonna have probably some problems with. I didn't know when I drilled wells up at Chena Hot Springs, we didn't have to go through. You guys got new rules, which I disagree with. So I want to get there, but now you got to have oil and gas. Which, you know, here's the problem. Oil and gas doesn't have a clue about geothermal. They think we've got an oil pool that's up north, and we don't. It's not even close. We have 60 PSI, so they're going to want us to have, you know, a $100,000 blowout preventer that nobody in the geothermal business uses. So none of it makes sense what they want. So how am I going to educate them? I got to go in there, and I got to convince them that you know, anyway, it's not going to be easy. I've asked for a waiver. They turned me down. So that's probably the biggest deal, is probably getting a drilling permit will probably be the biggest problem we have.
We got 3 minutes, and Senator Giesel has a question.
Very brief, I think. So I think Ormat had tried some geothermal drilling other locations as well, but abandoned it. Am I correct? How is
you're
it
you're
that
absolutely
you're
right.
That,
you're absolutely right, Senator. Through the chair, Senator Giesel, you're absolutely right. They were working. They got some grants from the state, and they didn't want to spend their own money. So once they used up all the money that was given to them, they said, well, we're done. They're good people. They're good people. They just didn't want to put any of their own money in. And God bless them. You know, but anyway, Mount Spur still has a lot of potential. You know, it's like finding a needle in a haystack. But if they would have done what I would have done, they would have hired me. I'd have gone over there with witching rods, and I'd have witched them a well, and they would have hit. That's how I would have done it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I have one last question, and this, then we're going to adjourn. It's been riveting. It really has. But you haven't said one thing about hydrogen production. Have you thought about that?
We applied to become a hydrogen hub, and we had the best team partners, I think, in the world. We should be a hydrogen hub. There is a report done on Unalaska Dutch Harbor that we didn't do. The Earth Muffins did, and the Posey Sniffers, and they did a really nice report. It's about that big, cost $500,000, and it says that the hydrogen hub should be at Unalaska Dutch Harbor, and that we should the fishing fleet should all be on hydrogen. We totally agree. We were going to do it without that report. We're still going to do it. Our teaming partners are Plug Power. They're the largest hydrogen producer in the States today. They have about 55,000 pieces of equipment running on hydrogen. They have 400 hydrogen gas stations they're putting in. And they are going to be a hydrogen hub. And they're well-oiled, and they're out of New York. And they just built a 245,000-square-foot plant there to build electrolyzers and fuel cells. Our idea is that we will become a hydrogen hub. We will provide hydrogen for the fishing fleet to hit. The fishing fleet of the future, and 190 villages will be on hydrogen in my lifetime because it makes sense. You can take the fuel cell, replace all the generators, deliver the liquid hydrogen there. There's zero emissions. You give off heat and drinking water, and that's what everybody needs in Bush, Alaska, and that's what all these boats need. So hydrogen is the fuel of the future. We're drinking our future. If Alaska would put more in our future, we'd have a better future.
Thank you for your presentation. That'll wrap up today's meeting. And tomorrow, it'd be Friday. Thank you. We'd like to set an amendment deadline for the SB 48 carbon offset program on state lands. That will be noon on Wednesday, April 19th will be that deadline. Our next meeting is Friday, April 14th at 3:30 p.m. On the agenda will be SB 92. State ownership of submerged lands, consideration of governor appointees for the Big Game Commercial Services Board, Michael Flores in Board of Fisheries. We have three up, Jared Godfrey, Greg Svensson, and Mike Wood. So we will gavel out at 5:04 p.m. Thank you all.